Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Philip Roth is an American writer, a great American novelist, winner of two National Book Awards and the Pulitzer Prize, author of Portnoy's Complaint, American Pastoral, and The Human Stain. His books paint an intricate, expansive, and increasingly compassionate picture of late 20th century America. He is also one of the most eminent writers of the American Jewish experience. Now, Philip Roth has turned his attention back to his own childhood in Newark, New Jersey, recast in a world that never existed. In his new novel, The Plot Against America, young Philip Roth grows up in an America where Charles Lindbergh is president. America has signed a non-aggression pact with Germany and Japan. Fascism lurks everywhere, and virulent anti-Semitism rises up against American Jews. Fear presides over these memories, Philip Roth, the author and the young boy, says, a perpetual fear. The Plot Against America is a commanding look at the question, what if it had happened here? Tonight on Point, American master Philip Roth. He joins me now from New York. Philip Roth, welcome to On Point, and thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you.
An amazing story with history retold here. It's been out now for a couple of months, and I wonder what you make of the response that you're getting from American readers, from Jewish American readers.
I haven't thought about Jewish American readers, but I have thought about readers. I never know what to make of the response to a book. It's always a surprise. And you never know how the book is entering the mind of the reader and why readers are enthusiastic about a book. And so I'm glad there are people reading it, and I'm glad it seems to be compelling for some readers, but I really can't figure out what's up.
I guess I ask, I mean, I'm interested in all readers. I ask about Jewish American readers in particular because over the span of your incredible career, you've occasionally taken brickbats from Jewish Americans saying, wow, you're laying all this stuff out there. Your portraits are so intimate. The interior lives are so complex. You've got this dark stuff. You're giving fuel at moments to would-be or actual anti-Semites. And I wonder if they look at this book and say, finally, Philip understands. He's come home. He gets why we've been worried.
I'd hate to think that they think I've come home. I think that accusations you speak of stopped a long time ago. At the very beginning, when I began to publish in the middle 50s, I began to publish short stories, I did begin to get very hostile reactions from some rabbis and even from some Jewish readers and critics. And then again, when I published Portnoy's Complaint, of course, there was a lot of noise. Mm. But since then, things have kind of quieted down. And I haven't really sensed that there's that kind of response. I think in part because the generation that was the members of the generation that took offense to my early work are no longer with us, mm-hmm. and I think it was generational to some degree. Who is this kid who appears out of nowhere, who has the nerve to do blah 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 blah?
Doesn't he know what we've been through?
Yes. Respected their concerns. I didn't like the insults, but I respected their concerns. I just thought they were wrongheaded.
And now you've gone back to the very time that maybe, you know, one of the taproots of that view, whatever it was then. We'll have listeners tonight who have read this book page by page, and it is a real page-turner. My gosh, what a rush. And others who won't have touched it at all. And I wish you'd be kind enough to give us the synopsis of the book the way you tell it. What's it about?
Oh, boy. It was hard enough to write. It's even harder to do a synopsis of it. I'll do my best, okay?
Thank you.
In giving you the synopsis, tell you how I came to write the book, because there's something there that may help those readers who are unfamiliar with the book. What I did was imagine that in 1940, in the presidential election, Franklin Roosevelt, who was the Democratic candidate, who was the president, he was running for a third term, ran against Charles Lindbergh, the famous aviator, when in fact, historical fact, he ran against Wendell Willkie, and he handily defeated Willkie and won a third term. It was a terribly important election in reality because America was on the brink, perhaps, of war. And the country was divided into those who were willing to follow Roosevelt if it was necessary to go to war against Hitler so as to save England and prevent fascism from conquering the entire continent and the British Isles. And those in the country who said, no, this was yet another European war. We had already fought in one between 1916 and 18. And people didn't want that, and they were in the majority, I think. I think those who did not want to go to war were in the majority. And the Republican Party was the spokesman for those who didn't want to go to war, and especially a wing of it which came to be called the isolationist or non-interventionist wing.
The America First crowd.
Pardon?
The America First crowd.
Yes, the America First crowd. And Lindbergh was a great believer in isolationism, and he was a great favorite of the America First organization. He was their preferred speaker. The second speaker was Senator Wheeler of Montana. And so what I imagined in my book was that, in fact, Lindbergh had defeated FDR in that election and became president. Now, in his kit of ideas, Lindbergh had the kind of Aryan ideology about the Jews and had made it clear in various speeches that he considered the Jews not only other from others in America, but that perhaps they were the ones who were leading us into war.
And here you're speaking quite factually beyond the fiction of the book. This is
yes,
a matter of
true.
Record.
Mm. He did make a famous speech in Des Moines in September 1941, just strangely enough, it's September 11th, 1941, which means it was 60 years to the date before 9/11.
Yeah.
And in which he did say, yes, there are three groups leading us into war, the British, the Roosevelt administration, and the Jews. And he elaborated. He was not a man who lacked candor, and this was a national broadcast. So once he becomes president, in my book, the Jews become quite worried.
And important to remember, to recall here, just how big he was. He was as big a star as there was a star for his Spirit of St. Louis and his flying and his image. He was as big as anyone got in those days.
Yes, he was the biggest. He was the most famous man in the world. The two most famous Americans at that time were both anti-Semites, Lindbergh and Henry Ford.
Yeah.
Henry Ford was more vicious, but they were the two most famous Americans everywhere. Strange to say, the Russians, I'm going off the track for a moment, idolized Henry Ford because of the assembly line. But at any rate, and Henry Ford appears in the cabinet. I make him Secretary, I think, of the Interior in the Lindbergh cabinet. I had more trouble choosing my cabinet than George Bush does. You know.
He seems pretty quick on the trigger.
Yes. I didn't choose just pals.
Right.
In my book, Lindbergh becomes president, and as I say, the American Jews start to worry. Nobody else worries. Everybody else is delighted because we don't go to war. Lindbergh makes a non-aggression pact first with Hitler. It's called the Iceland Understanding. They reach it in Reykjavik. And then he reaches an agreement with the Japanese in Hawaii. I think it's called the Hawaii Understanding. I forget. And therefore, he's neutralized potential enemies. And which is what any isolationist president would indeed have done.
No American boys will die. It's all hunky-dory.
That's right. No American boys will die. And the country is quite happy, and he's quite glamorous, and his wife is a lovely young woman. And the country is happy, and they adore them. It's the Jews who are afraid. And my book really focuses on that fear. Because Lindbergh doesn't do much in my book.
He flies around. He gives very short speeches. He disappears into the clouds again, and off he goes.
Right, like a god, like a mythic god. Nonetheless, what I wanted to explore was what would Jews have done in this situation? What would they have done with their fear? As you know the first line of the book is, fear presides over these memories, a perpetual fear.
Yes.
And there's one family who is at the center of the book, and it's my own. I decided in writing the book that I would make only one wild invention, and that is, the invention is this, that Lindbergh becomes president and defeats Roosevelt. Everything else I would keep as it was.
Including the young, essentially the narrator, 7, 8, 9 years old, named Philip.
Well, myself. I look over my shoulder, as it were, because that sentence I just quoted to you, a child couldn't speak. It's really spoken by the adult who's looking back at the experience of his family when he was a 7, 8, 9 year old in that family. And that's the premise. What I've just given you is the premise of the book, and the action goes on from there.
I wish, if you'd be good enough, Philip Roth, if you could just dip in on page 4. There's a couple of paragraphs here that give a sense of that moment before, as you have it in your fiction, before Lindbergh wins 57% of the popular vote and all the rest. I wish you could read just the kind of... That the snapshot, that moment in time.
Israel didn't yet exist. 6 million European Jews hadn't yet ceased to exist. And the local relevance of distant Palestine was a mystery to me. When a stranger who did wear a beard and who never once was seen hatless appeared every few months after dark to ask in broken English for a contribution toward the establishment of a Jewish national homeland in Palestine, I, who wasn't an ignorant child, didn't quite know what he was doing on our landing. My parents would give me or my brother a couple of coins to drop into his collection box. Largesse, I always thought, dispensed out of kindness so as not to hurt the feelings of a poor old man who, from one year to the next, seemed unable to get it through his head that we'd already had a homeland for 3 generations. I pledged allegiance to the flag of our homeland every morning at school. I sang of its marvels with my classmates at assembly programs. I eagerly observed its national holidays, and without giving a second thought to my affinity for the 4th of July fireworks, or the Thanksgiving turkey, or the Decoration Day doubleheader, our homeland was America. Then the Republicans nominated Lindbergh, and everything changed.
Philip Roth reading from his new book, The Plot Against America. And there's the moment, and things get very bad very, very quickly. This is kind of a hair-raising pace that you then set up as you throw down the net of fear. At the heart of it, this young boy, as in yourself, reimagined in these circumstances, and very much your parents, which you present, as I read them, almost as archetypes. How do you? What's the characterization of your parents that you want to come across here?
Well, I actually tried to be as photographically, in quotes, accurate as I could be. As I said a moment ago, having made the one big change, I wanted to keep everything else as close to the bone of reality as I could.
The father, so, early 40s, bursting with energy and determination and kind of a pugnacity. The mother, calm and taking care of business, holding this house together.
Pugnacity when defied by what he takes to be injustice. Otherwise not pugnacious really at all. These are the best portraits I can do of... my own dear parents when they were in their late 30s and early 40s at the height of their strength. Now, needless to say, I put them in a situation they did not have to face. There was no Aryan white supremacist in the White House. There was FDR in the White House, and we did go to war. But the task I set myself was to imagine how each of them, and my brother and myself, and then the invented characters, but to take the real characters, how we would have behaved, what would we have done? I bring tremendous pressure to bear on this family.
You sure do. Philip Roth, we've got to take a short break. If you can hold on just a moment. We're talking tonight with the great novelist Philip Roth. His new book is The Plot Against America. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with the novelist Philip Roth, two-time winner of the National Book Award, the Pulitzer Prize, many novels to his credit, Portnoy's Complaint, American Pastoral, The Human Stain, to name a few. His new book is The Plot Against America. It imagines 1940 America, where Charles Lindbergh defeats FDR for the presidency, and things get very rough very quickly into a swirl of fascism, cooperation with the Nazis, anti-Semitism, and all the rest. It's a wild ride of a read. Philip Roth is with me tonight from New York. And I wonder if you'd just pick up where we were for a moment there. Your parents, all this built around the structure, the life of your family, but with the, as you say, the all-important twist of Lindbergh in a different kind of presidency. What's the suggestion you're making about how possible this was? Is this, do you look back on this as very, very far-fetched? Or, you know, if the wind had blown differently, if a butterfly wing had fluttered somewhere differently, it could have happened.
Well, it's an interesting thing to think about. Let's begin by saying the obvious, which is that it did not happen here in America.
Something which you celebrate or have celebrated since the book came out. I mean,
well,
to say it happened in much of the world. It is pretty terrific.
It didn't happen, isn't it?
Yeah.
I needn't have wasted my time writing this book, you know, if it didn't happen.
Well, I guess what I mean to say is you, this is not a book. There's a kind of redemption here when you put up the stark alternative, the fictional alternative, and say it didn't happen. It puts that in high relief and frames how special that was and is that it didn't happen.
Yes, well, as I said somewhere else, it just shows how lucky we Americans are.
Yeah.
Were, I should say, and hope that we can continue to be. But in the 1930s, anti-Semitism was a Western phenomenon, and not just in Europe. The anti-Semitism was here as well. It was a serious matter. Even as a child, and I was only a child then, small child, but even as a small child, I understood that there was something out there that was fierce and serious that did not like us. And this is something for a small child to feel.
Growing up in Newark, New Jersey.
Not unusual in America, mm-hmm. too, because I mm-hmm. think that this has been the experience in America of many black children,
mm-hmm.
And of many other minorities, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
But in the 30s, there was a special force behind the anti-Semitism because it was being enacted in Europe on the grand scale by Hitler.
Yeah.
And the Jews in Germany were being denied all their rights, their property was being taken or destroyed, and they were being put, we knew this even in 1938-39, into concentration camps. We didn't know about the death camps. They didn't quite begin then. But they were coming. And so here in one's own country, through the voices of people like Lindbergh and Henry Ford and Father Coughlin, mm-hmm. The radio priest from Detroit, right. What a Sunday program, which was viciously, virulently anti-Semitic.
Entirely openly so. Mm-hmm.
And yes, very much so. You could turn it on the radio. I remember my father doing it.
Must have really steamed him.
Yes, it steamed him. I don't think he listened to it because these men particularly liked to get steamed up, but he wanted to know about the world he lived in.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to be sure about it. But I heard it. I mean, I would be 5 years old or 6 years old, and I heard it coming in. We weren't protected from this stuff. I heard Lindbergh discussed at the dinner table and so on. So what I imagined is something that didn't happen, but that looked for one moment as though it could possibly happen, though not with Roosevelt and the Democrats in power. One was pretty sure about that.
Yeah.
So we knew we had protection. And also, the whole legend and myth of America was powerful and real. So we felt protected by, I guess this is true, protected by America from this happening. So it remains somehow a threat, but not one that menaced us to the degree that it does in this book.
And yet in the book you show how, how if things just turn another way, you imagine at least how quickly and ferociously the wind can change. I don't want to give away too much, but I wish you'd give a sense of what ensues with the Lindbergh victory in the novel, The Plot Against America, of the whirlwind of change that comes and particularly buffets this well, many people, but through the eyes of this family in Newark.
I would go back and say that most of the people in America are quite, not most, 99% are quite happy with what happens in America. What happens is that Lindbergh comes to power, and within, I think, the first few weeks of his administration, makes this agreement with Hitler on the one hand and with the Japanese on the other, and encourages the armaments industry in America for us to be strong, and takes into his cabinet Henry Ford as Secretary of Interior, and his vice president is a Democrat. He chooses a Democrat from Montana who existed named Burton K. Wheeler, who I would think might well have taken the job. And
a Democrat, but a fiercely conservative Democrat.
Yeah, fiercely opportunistic Democrat.
Yeah, okay.
Because at one time he was fiercely radical when he first ran for governor in Montana, but that's another story.
Opportunism, a word that runs through your book, importantly. Mm.
You know, when you say the great change, you know, nothing happens. That is, once he's made these treaties, nothing happens.
Sort of.
The Jews
until
then are responding. Till it does. The Jews are really responding to their fears, which may or may not be legitimate. And that is what interested me.
The kind of ghost of anti-Semitism, wondering, wait, am I dreaming or is this nightmare unfolding? What's real? What can I trust? How far might this go?
What can I trust? Mm-hmm. What can I trust? Very much so. And as you know, in the book, there is a rabbi, Bengelsdorf, who's a leading figure, who goes to work for the Lindbergh administration and tries to assure the Jews that he will look after their interests and they don't have to worry.
These are the fears of ghetto Jews, as he describes it. Get over it. Be Americans. Lighten up.
Well, he says all the right things, Rabbi Bengelsdorf. The problem is he's on the wrong side. He says many things that are, I don't know, perfectly acceptable, but he's on the wrong side. Now, two things do happen. Two pieces of legislation, or maybe they're executive orders, I don't know, but I have them happening in the book. One is the establishment of a plan called Just Folks, which is gives an opportunity to Jewish kids between the ages of, let's say, I don't know, 12 and 15 or 16, to go and spend the summer working on a farm in the American heartland. And my brother in the book seizes on this opportunity. He's tremendously enthusiastic about it. And he goes out to Kentucky and has a wonderful time working on a tobacco farm. My father says this is the way that Lindbergh is subtly going to try to turn Jewish kids against their families.
Right.
So is my father right or wrong? Who knows? You know, is it his paranoia or is he on to something?
And there's a tremendous fight between this brother and the father, just seeing it diametrically oppositely. The son goes to Kentucky and loves it, which makes the father crazy.
Yes, he has a good time. So the next thing that happens is, I think some months later, or maybe it's a year later, and it's the only other thing that happens, by the way, is that there's another piece of legislation called Homestead 42, meaning 1942, and it's the name for the Homestead Act of 1842. And this is a plan to relocate Jews who work for large corporations or large institutions, as my father did, which is Metropolitan Life, to offices these companies have in very remote places. And this my father is sure is a piece of anti-Semitic legislation, largely because, and my mother too, largely because it's involuntary.
You are being reassigned.
Yes. It's one thing to say, how wouldn't you love to go out to Boulder, Colorado, and ski, you know? But this is, you are going to Boulder, Colorado.
But it's all conveyed with a kind of smiling, this folksy fascism, as you craft it. You'll love it. It'll be, you know, fresh air and sunshine. This is good for you, good for the country. Congratulations.
I like folksy fascism. That's very good. Yes, I wanted to keep the folksiness. I thought that was the appeal they would try to make. Mm-hmm. And as a result, my father, rather than moving us, because the fear of displacement is tremendous, and that's true throughout the book, quits his job.
Yeah.
And goes to work for a very tough uncle who's in the book. But the important thing is that these two things and some anti-Semitic incidents that occur cause the family to wonder whether they should stay or leave. My mother wants to go to Canada. She goes out and gets a job so she can send her paycheck to a bank in Montreal. The family is in turmoil, and the family descends really into violence. Actually, at least small-scale domestic violence kind that was unfamiliar to them before.
And disastrous on a domestic scale. I mean, very disruptive.
Yes, exactly.
There's great moments here when the family's on their visit to Washington and they begin to run into this. This is after Lindbergh has won, and anti-Semitism is creeping in all around them, really lapping against their feet, turned away from a hotel, come to a cafeteria where the father's mere mention of Walter Winchell gets empowered anti-Semites eating around them to become quite aggressive, and the father sort of singing in defiance there. Also the moment where the cousin goes off to fight with the Canadians in Europe against the Germans and comes back grievously wounded. Philip Roth, there's another small reading I wish you'd do for us here that points to history and your sense of it in this book. This is when the young cousin Alvin has come back from Europe.
A new life began for me. I'd watched my father fall apart, and I would never return to the same childhood. The mother at home was now away all day working for Haynes. The brother on call was now off after school working for Lindbergh. And the father who'd defiantly serenaded all those callow cafeteria anti-Semites in Washington was crying aloud with his mouth wide open, crying like both a baby abandoned and a man being tortured, because he was powerless to stop the unforeseen. And as Lindbergh's election couldn't have made clearer to me, the unfolding of the unforeseen was everything. Turned wrong way round, the relentless unforeseen was what we schoolchildren studied as history, harmless history, where everything unexpected in its own time is chronicled on the page as inevitable. The terror of the unforeseen is what the science of history hides, turning a disaster into an epic.
Philip Roth, this paragraph just stopped me, really made me think, I'm sure it will many readers. The terror of the unforeseen is what the science of history hides, turning a disaster into an epic. And it made me think how much more you've turned to history after starting with such personal books. You're really becoming a major chronicler of American history, first between the war and Vietnam and on, and now going back even before the war. What's turned you from a more personal perspective to this nation-embracing historical kind of mission, almost, it looks like, at this point?
Well, I suppose, I mean, I'm probably the last person you should ask, but I suppose several things. Conjecture. One is the sheer fact of getting older, which provides perspective. You live through decade after decade as a conscious adult and alert adult, and you see the things that occur. And in these last decades, beginning with, as you said, the Vietnam War, plenty of stuff has happened. And I was engaged. I was a bit like my father in response to many of these things. So on the one hand, there's just the passage of time.
Yeah.
Secondly, I was away from America for about 12 years in the 70s and through most of the 80s.
What were you doing?
So I was living in England mostly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so the Vietnam War had come and gone by the time I left. I think I left about 76. And the war was over, I think, in 74 finally. And then I didn't come back until 89. And so I was really unplugged from American life. And I tried to keep up. I was interested, of course, but it was hard from a distance. And when I came back in 1989, I felt wonderful to be back.
Hmm.
And I remember walking around thinking very simply, I'm home, I'm back. And I realized then, and realized quite consciously, that I had a new subject, which was an old subject, and that was this place that I came from, America. And it was very fresh for me. I saw it as a subject. I'd never seen it as a subject before. Now, the subject would always be transmuted into the lives of people, America, that is. But nonetheless, the large events stuck out. And I remember coming when I came back in 89, I must have read, I don't know, 25 or 30 American novels from the, not contemporary novels, but from the 20th century, beginning with Dreiser and Sherwood Anderson and Hemingway and Faulkner and so on. I just couldn't get enough of America.
Yeah.
And I guess about that time, the direction of my interest changed. And I began to write these books. I would think that one would have to include a book that isn't strictly speaking about America, and that is Operation Shylock, which, and even going back to The Counterlife, which I think is 1985, has this very strong historical frame. So it isn't as neat as I just made it in the description, but I think you can see the tug and where it came from.
Philip Roth, stand by. We've got to take a short break. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back with the novelist, Philip Roth. His new book is The Plot Against America. It's quite a tale. What if Charles Lindbergh had won the presidency in 1940? What if FDR was out? What if anti-Semitism, fascism, had become the way of the land? And then things turn around in quite remarkable ways. We'll be back with Philip Roth in just a moment. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Philip Roth, author of the new novel, The Plot Against America. I was looking back here at a book that I'm sure you're, of course, aware of, Sinclair Lewis's It Can't Happen Here in the 1930s. A story not so terribly different in its gist, I mean, about fascism, a fascist outbreak in the United States. But in his case, warning of it in advance, now you're looking back many years later. I wonder if you referenced the book at all. Was it a reference point for you? How do you see yours in contrast?
I don't know the book. Needless to say, when I was writing my book, I took a look at it and I found it unreadable. The writing is so bad, you know.
Yeah.
And it's all very blatant and obvious. So I just read maybe, I don't know, 20 pages of it, but I didn't know that book of Sinclair Lewis's from my past. But, of course, I knew the title because the title was a slogan in the 30s. It wasn't Lewis's invention. He rather took a current slogan and used it as the title, which many writers do. The only works of Lewis I knew were books I'd read in college, Babbitt and Main Street.
Yeah.
And he's not a writer I've ever gone back to because I find him quite flat.
I guess I asked because he was writing this as a warning, as a kind of a crusader, a polemicist almost. I wonder how you see your role as you've turned to these more history-oriented works. Those that were more personal, there's a kind of exploration going on. But when you write, when you take up history in this way, about a nation rather than yourself, do you inevitably become a kind of teacher? Is that how you see yourself?
Mm-mm. No. No, I just see myself as a novelist. And not even that every day. I just try to work it out, you know. I just try to work out the thought. I just try to make it live.
You don't have a civic mission in mind? Because the book reads as though there's a civic mission at work.
I'm very uncivic-minded.
I would have said that a couple of decades ago, but reading this, you seem plugged into the political
way.
What would I be being
civic-minded about? I'm not trying to prevent anything from happening.
Really?
Or make any?
Is that true?
No, absolutely. Or make anything happen. First of all, any novelist in America would have to be out of his mind if he thought he could make something happen with a book of all things. And I certainly am not one of those who thinks that way, at any rate. No, I'm just writing books.
But you've written since the book came out in the Times, of course, critically about George Bush, a man unfit to run a hardware store, let alone a nation like this, when you wrote. Then you wrote this, again, not in the book, but after, you said, who has merely reaffirmed for me the maxim that informed the writing of all these books and that makes our lives as Americans as precarious as anyone else's. All the assurances are provisional, even here in a 200-year-old democracy. That sounds like quite a civically engaged novelist.
If you want it that way, will it be that way? But all assurances are provisional is what the subject of my book is.
Mm-hmm. As in the Constitution and everything else.
Yes. And I only seek to work these things out in convincing stories. And for me, these notions of Lindbergh and, excuse me, of fascism and anti-Semitism only have meaning in as much as I can figure out how they work themselves into the bloodstreams of these people, you know. Mm. Otherwise, as soon as the conversation gets abstract, I sort of doze off or my eyes glaze over. And I think what one has to find is a language in which to describe a book like this, which does justice to the sentence-by-sentence and page-by-page specific data. The book lives or dies through its control, imaginative control of the specific data. A book is made out of 10,000 little tiny pieces, and I've got to make those pieces. And it's not made out of general ideas. The book is the enemy of general ideas. I mean, novels for me are the enemies of generalizations. Mm. Therefore, I mean, I will talk in generalizations which seem to me more or less to, you know, be in the same arena as my book. But nonetheless, my interest really is in those 10,000 or 50,000, however many there are, tiny pieces of specific data which add up to the mosaic that's the story.
And yet there's some large framing here. We've just got a couple minutes. We could do a couple hours. But after this 57% victory of Charles Lindbergh's, I won't get into the details, but there's ultimately a kind of turnaround here, which is sort of reaffirming of what a reader reads into it, of the American character or polity or tradition, call it what you will. You've got a sense of the states. I wonder, did you know at the outset that you were going to have this take a U-turn before it was all over?
I didn't know nothing at the outset. The important thing to remember is that it didn't happen. That's the most optimistic statement you can make.
Do you feel optimistic after the politics of these recent years as a novelist who's also a citizen and looking on with the rest of us?
I feel optimistic about the past. I feel optimistic that, that this did not happen in America. And it's a blessing. And I'm not being cynical or playful when I say this. It's something wonderful that this didn't happen at a time when it did happen in many other places and might even, as you said very earlier on, might even have happened here. I think there's another, if someone wants an idea for another book, the other book is this, and then I'll let you go. That is that if Hoover had won a second term against Roosevelt in 32, then I think this might have happened because he refused to address the Depression. It would have gone wildly out of hand. There would have been a kind of mini unsuccessful revolution which would have been put down very quickly. And then, who knows?
Somehow, I have a feeling your imagination, Philip Roth, may be off in other directions, but we'll contemplate that one in the meantime.
Okay,
thank you so much for being with us. Just great talking with you.
And nice to talk to you.
Novelist Philip Roth, his new book is The Plot Against America. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
I'm proud to announce my nomination of Commissioner Bernard Kerik as the Secretary of Homeland Security.
I promise you, Mr. President, that both the memory of those courageous souls and the horrors I saw inflicted upon our proud nation will serve as permanent reminders of the awesome responsibility you place in my charge.
I submitted to President Bush my resignation as Secretary of Health and Human Services.
The election should not be postponed. It's time for the Iraqi citizens to go to the polls.
The Supreme Court's decision ordering a runoff of the second round with the two candidates who participated in the November 21st race, it's pretty much handing the opposition exactly what they had hoped for.
I'm not pointing a finger of accusation at Kofi Annan in terms of, you know, putting money in his own pocket. We have not sorted out how high the corruption goes, but it's clear that under his reign, the corruption occurred.
We do have drug testing, but we need a tougher policy with tougher punishments and other situations. That's just, it's to me beyond debate.
I feel that I have the same right as every other American in this country to have the right to live, to have the right to be as free of pain as I possibly can.
Thanks for all that I have learned from you. That's been my richest reward. That's Nightly News for this Wednesday night. I'm Tom Brokaw. You'll see Brian Williams here tomorrow night, and I'll see you along the way.
And there's a week. Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridge resigns. Former New York City Police Commissioner Bernard Kerik is nominated to take his place. Health and Human Services Commissioner Tommy Thompson announces his resignation as well. President Bush says he's standing by the January 30th timeline for elections in Iraq, despite continued violence, and calls there to move the date back. After weeks of unrest, Ukraine's Supreme Court nullifies the country's disputed presidential election and orders a repeat of its runoff round. Minnesota Senator Norm Coleman calls for the resignation of U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan after deeming the U.N.'s Iraq Oil for Food program corrupt. Leaked grand jury testimony confirms that the New York Yankees' Jason Giambi knowingly used performance-enhancing steroids, and slugger Barry Bonds and others are also under increased scrutiny. The Supreme Court hears arguments over whether states can allow medicinal use of marijuana, and after 23 years at the helm of NBC Nightly News, anchorman Tom Brokaw says goodbye. Jack Beatty, there's a week, and behind it all, the war has raged on in Iraq in this last month like nobody's business.
Yes, it appears that November was the cruelest month for American forces of the occupation. As of yesterday, 135 dead, and they were waiting for reports from the whole report from Fallujah. So it looks like it'll be in excess of that. And one of these casualties was Jeffrey Holmes, age 20, who was buried today in White River Junction, Vermont, at the Greater Hartford United Church of Christ Church. 900 people came to his service. He graduated last year from Hartford High School, where he was a football player. His football jersey was on display. His hockey jersey was on display. He worked at Shaw's supermarket in Lebanon. He had a dog named Thor, whom he loved. People looked at his yearbook and were struck by his smiling face. 20 years old, dead Thanksgiving Day, Jeffrey S. Holmes of Hartford, Vermont.
Young, like so many of the soldiers there, and so many of the casualties are very young.
Yes, they are. And, you know, when you think about these things, once these nationalist insurgencies get going, I mean, the French in Vietnam, the Americans in Vietnam, the French in Algeria, the Soviets in Afghanistan, the Israelis in Lebanon, the one case, and we were talking about it earlier, where a counterinsurgency led by foreign troops has worked was in Malaya, the British. Mm-hmm. But that took 12 years.
A long time.
And how many more Jeffrey Holmes die in the meantime? And, you know, I occasionally look at these Iraqi bloggers. Now, you don't know who they are. I mean, they could well be guerrillas, for all one knows.
But they present themselves as Iraqis in Iraq coming online to share their thoughts.
That's right. And I looked at one today, Anwar Hussein, and he just paints a terrible picture. He says, Fallujah has been laid waste. It has been bombed, rebombed, its citizens gunned down. It's a hell on earth, reeking of death. He says that the mortuary teams are collecting the dead rotting in the city streets, fighting the wandering dogs that are looking for their former masters. And he ends with a condemnation. Fallujah will enter history as the place where the United States carried out an offensive of heinous proportions this November, a monstrous crime far beyond any possible forgiveness.
One blogger presented as an Iraqi. On the other side, we know what Fallujah was before the U.S. military went in there. And I have to say, Jack, even now, though after Fallujah, you've seen some odd comments coming. But overall, the U.S. soldiers' morale seems high. They still, when I hear them speak, they seem determined. They don't want this to be a disaster. They don't want to be fighting for a disaster. They want to be fighting for something good.
Of course they do, and, you know, but as one of the young men at this funeral today remarked, those people over there just don't seem to want us, and many of them don't. On the other hand, you're right. I mean, there are some people do, and a member of the Iraqi provisional government said he thinks the United States needs to spend another decade there in order to solidify matters for the Iraqi people.
It may be that kind of 12-year Malaya solution. That will be a tremendous test. Of what? Of American commitment, of the hospitality of the Middle East and Islam, of the Iraqi people in blood.
Yes, and of our people. You know, I mean, will there be an anti-war movement developing? You know, the war is now much less popular than the Vietnam War was in, say, 1968. There was still majority support for that. It's about 50-50 now. And if, as that wears away, more politicians will be emboldened to come out and say, enough, let's get this to a rapid conclusion and bring the troops home.
Well, a lot riding on those January, at least scheduled January elections. If it appears that progress is being scraped out there, presumably that will have people buying in for another round. But if it doesn't appear to buy anything, then there's no signpost here.
There aren't. And so much is being attached to this. And, of course, many, many people want it to be postponed. And perhaps that's the best thing, given the security situation.
President Bush says no, and on we go. Jack, have a great weekend. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.